Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, July 2nd. The Public Utilities Commission regulates everything from what you pay for inter-island shipping rates to energy generation. We get to know the new head of the PUC as we navigate our energy future. We consider the point of view of Hawaiians living offshore about the care of cultural treasures in museums across the globe. And what does Independence Day mean to you? We pose the question as we mark the origin story of our country in the 4th of July. A Big Island chef took top honors on this season's reality show, Top Chef. And a native Hawaiian author's debut novel, In Verse, uses poetry to tell a coming-of-age story that's not just for kids.
Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust, with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. John Itamura took the helm of the Hawaii Public Utilities Commission this year. He may be new to that role, but the commission is familiar ground. He spent 16 years working as legal counsel for the Consumer Advocate and making his case before the commission. He spoke with HPR Savannah Harriman Poet about what it's like to be on the other side and what he hopes to accomplish as commission chair.
It was always my belief that the Consumer Advocate's role and the commission's role are very, very similar, if not identical. Up front and foremost are the interests of ratepayers, and the Consumer Advocate as well as the commission are looking at very similar issues, but more specifically the commission. Our goal is to work towards 100% renewable future, and I'm definitely going to be stressing on affordability and reliability.
And to stay with you on that for a moment, affordability being how expensive is energy, right? What in your mind constitutes reliability?
Reliability is just the, put very simply, is the ability for the utility to keep the lights on, keep energy flowing. And that could appear many different forms in terms of, natural disaster, times of natural disasters or other events that provide challenges to providing energy. Those need to be taken into consideration. So you want to avoid or have very few or little interruptions in service. You want to provide resilience in the system. And those do add to the cost, but it is very important because in the end, people need to have the lights on. They need to have the energy available.
In 2015, the state committed to eliminating fossil fuels in its grid system. It has a deadline of 2045, so we have 30 years to take this on. It does feel like we're in kind of an awkward adolescence period of that transition, where many people remain committed to that goal, but there's disagreement on how exactly we're going to get there. Is there specific work you want to do in your tenure as chair to further that progress?
Yes, we are faced with many challenges. We are in an adolescent stage. Many jurisdictions are looking at Hawaii for guidance in how we're going to reach our 100% renewable goals. Across the nation, there are other jurisdictions with similar goals of 100%. Given that, technology provides so much change in such short time. It's hard to pinpoint one or, a few things that would help us reach that goal. But during my tenure, what's most important for me is keeping our eyes and ears open and moving as fast as we can with the knowledge that we have before us. And so we can't be caught up in analysis paralysis, given that you have that almost a contradiction of technology moving so fast, yet decisions needing to be made in the present. But we'll be doing the best we can in moving forward and being flexible as new technologies come aboard.
July 4th is a critical deadline for commercial and utility scale solar projects to get underway in order to qualify for remaining federal tax incentives. And since the federal government set these looming deadlines, developers have asked the commission to expedite its process. And during your confirmation hearing, lawmakers also brought up concerns about the slow nature of the commission's work. Given the complexity of the work that the commission does, what can be done in your view to expedite your workflow?
With the July 4th deadline looming, as well as the developers needing and requesting expedited review by the commission, definitely I'm making it a priority for the commission to process applications with very little delay. You know, my experience with the Division of Consumer Advocacy and participation in numerous dockets is that often the commission is very open to requests for delay or additional time with respect to various items that need to be filed. And one thing leads to another, and months go by, you know, and that's something that we need to avoid in order to address both concerns by the legislature as well as administration and, of course, our very own office and the needs of the commercial utility project developers. So, therefore, we'll definitely be moving faster. We've moved forward very quickly on several projects already, certain purchase power agreements such as Waiau, Mahi Solar, both on Oahu, including Puloa Solar, and then Kuihilani Phase 2 solar project on Maui. Again, these are PPAs that we've tried to move along as quick as we could.
The PUC has been tasked with creating rules for a liability cap that would determine the ceiling on what an electric utility has to pay if its equipment is implicated in a catastrophic wildfire. What are the main things you feel the commission is weighing on this topic?
The liability cap, you know, we've been tasked by the legislature as well to address this issue. And it's a very complicated and contested issue. But the idea is to create a structured and predictable way to fund wildfire recovery, protecting customers and communities from events that create these sudden and high cost shifts. The idea is that the liability cap will also help protect the utility's financial stability, as well as ensuring that the grid remains reliable and the utility is allowed to continue to invest in clean energy projects.
Public comment on that rulemaking process closed. We're speaking on June 30th. I believe it closes today. Can you give us insight into the next steps in the rulemaking process?
Well, there are a lot of steps ahead of us. The next steps will actually begin the formal rulemaking process, which includes the actual drafting and promulgation of draft rules, followed by yet another public comment period. So put simply, as the ideas are put on paper with respect to specific provisions, then they'll be provided to stakeholders and the public to add their input as to what their concerns and priorities are.
The commission's work is really consequential. It also often goes unnoticed by the public. What do you think could be done during your tenure to encourage more public participation in the commission?
So with respect to, you know, engaging our customers and the public in general, and these are the customers of the energy-related utilities, the PUC has been hard at work on our website and also our newsletter and the reach of our newsletter. So the newsletter does go out to the legislature on a more regular basis than it has in the past. And I think this is very important, as the legislature could also, you know, be a means of educating its constituents. And the idea that the ratepayers and the customers of the utilities need to get more involved and do their part by utilizing the programs provided by organizations such as Hawaii Energy, and also providing input so that the Public Utilities Commission can develop better community benefit packages within the process of new projects being developed on all of our islands.
We have been hearing from Public Utilities Commission Chair John Itomura. He was talking about what he says is the commission's most pressing work.
Support for HPR comes from Parker Ranch, celebrating Hawaii's Paniolo tradition and the community at its 62nd annual rodeo and horse races this Saturday. Ticket locations in Waimea and at parkerranch.com.
Live from the Atherton presents Inside the Song, an intimate evening of live music and conversation featuring Nā Hoku Hanahana Award-nominated songwriters sharing the stories behind their songs. Presented in partnership with the Hawaii Academy of Recording Arts. Tickets are limited and available at hprtickets.org. This event is sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters, featuring Ka'u Black Honey with notes of maple butter, tamarind, and wildflower honey at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com or at their cafe in Hilo.
On HPR's website, we feature an article by a new contributor. Megan Ululani Boynton is based in Seattle and is a business reporter for the Seattle Times. Locally, she writes for Kawaiʻola, the publication for the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. You may have also seen her work on Aloha State Daily. We had a chance to talk to her about a piece she wrote about the perspective of Hawaiians living abroad on the display of artifacts held by museums across the globe.
The story really started with a discourse that was happening around the exhibit at the British Museum, but I felt that there were a lot of conversations happening online among Kanaka Maoli communities, both on the islands and in the diaspora, talking about complicated feelings around museum exhibits like the British Museum and kind of the right and wrong ways for museums to hold some of our sacred objects. And so I really wanted to dive into that in this particular article, because I felt that perspective hadn't really been reported out yet. And so what I had found generally is that most Kanaka Maoli believe that our items should be returned to the aina, back to the land. We should be building relationships with these museums in order to make that happen. And then in my research, I've found that that's actually appears to be the direction in which a lot of that is going. Because for instance, UC Berkeley returned about 335 items to Hawaii in 2024. The National Museums of Northern Ireland, Martha's Vineyard Museum, University of Maine. This is all over the past 2 or 3 years that we've been seeing more repatriations of either Iwi Kupuna or sacred objects back to the islands. And that's generally what I think the goal is for most Kanaka Maoli.
I know that the head of that exhibit, Elise Christoph, she had worked at the Bishop Museum as a collections manager and was instrumental in getting the British Museum exhibit together in collaboration with some of the local folks here just to be able to present it properly. And we posed that question about repatriation. I mean, some of those items were gifts, but some of them, you know, provenance unknown. But it was significant that the British Museum was able to publish this catalog of their entire collection of everything from this area here, from our area. What were you hearing from folks about that?
So one of the sources I spoke with, who's a Kanaka Maoli content creator in Washington, Benjamin Ka'imi Pono Okalore, he talked about how there are certain special circumstances, such as diplomatic gifts from the Hawaiian Kingdom to other countries like the UK, that warrant further consideration and further conversations. But there is also the aspect that many museums are kind of trying to make up for historically, which is that many items are looted from different countries, from different indigenous peoples. And so I understand that Kanaka Maoli community generally wants to right that wrong and be able to malama and take care of these items ourselves and have them returned to us. Another source I spoke with, Sarah Leilani Sissom, she's a Chicago-based indigenous heritage advocate who works in repatriation of Native human remains and sacred items. She had talked about the importance of having Native peoples involved in this process in general, you know, museums that view Native people as stakeholders, because often museums that are working directly with indigenous populations, they're more likely to observe cultural protocols when it comes to caring for Native objects. You know, sometimes they can even invite Native peoples like Kanaka Maoli to have meaningful interactions with these objects and educate the institutions on proper stewardship. So I think when it comes to exhibits like the British Museums, having as much input as possible from Kanaka Maoli back on the islands and in the diaspora, making sure that they're going about this in the most appropriate and respectful way, I think is the way forward when it comes to the opinions of the sources I spoke with.
Yeah, and we were hearing lots of interest in that. Hopefully that exhibit in London would travel so that folks who weren't able to make it over there this spring could actually see for themselves. I know one of the things at the forums, the public forums that were held here in the community, was that how are our facilities? Would it be Bishop Museum? Would it be somebody else who would be the caretakers? Because there are lots of questions that are being raised about, can we safeguard them as well as the British Museum has for hundreds of years? Do we have the proper climate control facilities? Do we have the proper fire suppression systems in place? Because we saw what happened in Brazil, where we had a hula and, you know, that cloak burned in a fire there. So that was an unfortunate cultural loss. But do we have the wherewithal here to protect the Ivy and those precious treasures?
I certainly think that the perspective from my Kanaka Maoli community is that we would love to give that a shot and work out the details as these are being repatriated. I know that one Hawaii-based nonprofit, Hui Ivi Kuamo'o, has really been leading the charge in trying to repatriate and make connections with these museums to bring these items back to the aina. So generally, we believe that we are the ones who are best disposed to take care of these items that belong to us historically. And so definitely, there is certainly room for, I think, more conversations about upgrading systems and updating things. But on the other hand, thinking about having these items and these Ivi Kupuna just sitting on shelves, because so much of a museum's collection isn't displayed, you know, sitting on shelves in a back room, although it might be climate controlled, it's far away from home. You know, we wonder about who is taking care of this. It's mana. I think that we believe that Kanaka are the ones that are best placed to make those kinds of decisions.
That was something that was raised as well about how long the exhibit was going to run. And some of the concern was, well, some of those artifacts are in such good condition because they were kept and protected from light and extra handling. And so that's something else to consider. But, you know, over the years, there have been calls for an organization like OHA to step up, or Kamehameha Schools. You know, would they find a way to somehow have more ownership and more say in a museum where we're bringing items back from across the globe?
Sure. And I know that OHA and Hui Ivi Kuamo'o, they have worked together in some of these repatriation cases. So I definitely think that both of those parties would be interested in exploring how to further this conversation about repatriation. I would be really interested, too, in hearing kind of what Kamehameha Schools has to say when it comes to any part that they'd like to play in this. But I definitely think that there are multiple entities that are really interested in moving the bar forward on this issue.
Yeah, because preservation can get expensive, right? And you're going to need to properly care for these things. And earlier this year, we saw Bishop Museum and Hawaii repatriate items back to Guam and the Northern Marianas. You know, there were, I think it was 10,000 pieces, artifacts in the collection. They did send back Ivi that the Bishop Museum brought back from Guam. And questions were raised about the care. There were some Lati stones that were discovered on campus there that were in pieces. And that Lati stone had been erected on campus, but then somehow over the decades, they didn't really understand maybe the significance. And I think just the care under which these items, whether they be from this island or another island, are we going to care for those things properly?
Absolutely. That's a heartbreaking example. Kanaka Maoli not only want to see our items cared for, but I think indigenous peoples everywhere want to, in Pacifica and beyond, want to make sure that their items are being approached with the proper malama. And so that is really disheartening to hear about those particular stones, because I know that the source that I spoke with wants to make sure that these items and these Ibikapuna are able to be cared for by the next seven generations.
Yes. And I know that at the time, and I didn't realize this until just recently, that, and for full disclosure, that my brother had been involved in the inventory of Evie and some of those items at Bishop Museum in his job with the government of Guam. But he said at the time, Guam did not have a facility that could properly care for it. And they thought the best place for everything was here in Hawaii at the Bishop Museum, because they could do better.
Sure. Now, I know that an example that one of the sources I spoke with for the story, Ipo Wright, who's the founder of a Washington-based organization called Hawaiian Diaspora, something that she had said that she felt could be an adequate approach for museums to take moving forward is, instead of retaining some of these sacred items, you know, these Ibikapuna, using Kanaka Maoli and their expertise and their lived experiences to create exhibits about Hawaiian culture that don't necessarily need those items. So for example, in Seattle at the Wing Luke Museum, there's an ongoing exhibit called Displace, and she believes that it appropriately showcases Hawaiian history and artwork. And it's curated by two Kanaka Maoli artists who have had input on all of this. I don't believe it includes any Ibikapuna. This is all contemporary and perhaps recent history. Items from recent history that they are able to use in Seattle away from the islands that more appropriately, I think, shares the Hawaiian experience with people who are visiting the museum.
Yes. And when I was doing research before I went to the British Museum in London, I was comparing policies about repatriation. And when I checked with the Bristol Museum, which has a long and very deep maritime history there in the UK, their policy is actually quite progressive and talks about decolonization and returning items and having that indigenous input. And I know when I checked with Noel Kahanu, who was involved in helping steward some of the exhibit there in London, she had said, yeah, that's extremely progressive. And it just sounds like there may be conversations to be had down the road as to how do we best handle these items and protect them.
Totally. And in the U.S., there's also the National Museum of the American Indian Act, and that's a law that requires the return of Kanaka, Ibikapuna, and funerary objects that are held by the Smithsonian. There are other provisions in there, too, that are directed at other indigenous communities in the U.S., but that is definitely, there is a legal bar that some institutions have to follow, and so I think that is also helping to move the conversation forward.
Well, that was HPR contributor Megan Ululani-Boynton. Look for her story on our website. You can also find HPR's coverage of the British Museum exhibit. We were there for the January opening and explored questions about repatriation and care and safekeeping of cultural treasures in museums. Look for our coverage on our website or on Spotify or Apple. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's backyard quiz, we think of the line, give me liberty or give me death. This weekend, we will mark the 250th birthday of the United States of America. On July 4th, 1776, the 13 original American colonies signed the Declaration of Independence, severing their ties to Great Britain. Although this is a happy holiday, often marked by grilling and fireworks celebrations, it can be a dangerous one. On average, more than 45,000 people visit U.S. hospital emergency rooms for injuries related to fireworks, swimming, and barbecuing. The holiday could also pose a threat to your wallets, as Americans are expected to spend almost $22 billion this weekend. We were surprised to discover that a number of U.S. presidents have actually died on the 4th. For today's news quiz, we want to know how many. Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
Nation's birthday can be a complicated day here in the islands. Some love it, others don't. Most are just happy to have the day off. HPR's Kevin Allen took to Honolulu sunny streets to ask folks how they felt about the 4th of July and the state of our nation. Here's Tim from Salt Lake.
I personally feel very patriotic about it. Like, I feel like as an American, it's very much so believing the ideals of what our country was founded on and what it can be and how it can progress to be better. And it doesn't necessarily have to reflect, being a patriot doesn't necessarily mean that you agree with what's going on with the administration, if you agree or not. It really means that you really believe as a citizen that this is a good country. My family believed this was a good country to move here from the Philippines. So I like to believe in the ideals that brought them here and made me get a fortunate life here. So it will cause certain feelings towards people, but at least for me, like I'm happy that my family moved here and I'm patriotic. You know, not everybody can be happy about everything about this country, but we can at least believe that, at least for the majority of us, we do live a good life here.
How do you celebrate the 4th? How are you gonna be celebrating this upcoming 4th of July?
Definitely not fireworks. I actually saw that fireworks explosion happen a couple years back. It happened on the street of my grandma's house, so I literally had a direct view of it. So if anything, quiet with family, you know, honor the country, honor what we believe that it could be. So very small family gathering. That's how I'm celebrating it.
And here's Doug, who has lived in Honolulu for 35 years. He said he feels a range of emotions when it comes to the 4th and the state of our country.
Well, it's mixed emotions. I mean, moving to Hawaii from the mainland and Boston in particular, where the 4th of July is fundamental, I didn't know about our country until I came here and realized what we had done, you know, outside the country and the experience Hawaii had. So it kind of changed it, but I learned a lot more having lived here, and I don't know, the state of affairs today makes it even more critical, because a lot of the country appears to be embracing socialism, communism, and I'd say great, all for it, if you can show me somewhere where it's actually worked. Because didn't we just spend the last 10 years yelling Russia, Russia, Russia?
How are you planning to spend your 4th of July?
Sure. Go surf if I can. I mean, what else can you do?
And Katie is here from San Francisco visiting her husband's family. For her, the trip and the holiday are an escape from the events that are happening on the continent.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying not to pay too much attention to what's going on in Washington. I'm going to more focus on spending time with family. My husband was born and raised here, so we're here for the month to spend time with his parents. And we're going to grill and focus more on that than being patriotic, really, I guess.
And Dane from Manoa feels ambivalent toward the national holiday.
grew up in Hawaii, 4th of July has never been a big celebration holiday. I don't think people in Hawaii are that patriotic, but usually the big celebrations around New Year's, so.
Yeah.
Just another day, you know. I lived in New York City for a number of years, and 4th of July was a much a bigger deal there than it is here. It's kind of just like another day here, which is sort of, you know, it's a Saturday.
And how are you planning on spending this 4th of July?
I have a friend, I think he's looking at doing a bar crawl. So I think that's probable.
And Garrett, who hails from Salt Lake, just enjoys the simple pleasures in life.
I think it's awesome. It's a holiday. We can drink beer and pop fireworks.
That's the best answer I've heard all day. Yeah, I mean, you know, how are you planning to celebrate this 4th of July?
My daughter has a basketball tournament, so probably watch her game and then barbecue after.
Okay. We have been hearing from residents and visitors about their plans for the upcoming July 4th holiday and their thoughts on the state of our country as we mark its 250th birthday. Got a reflection to share? Call us and leave a voicemail at 808-792-8217. Hawaii Island chef Rhoda Magbatang is this season's winner of Top Chef, the popular Bravo reality cooking competition show. Chef Rhoda grew up in the Philippines, and she moved to the U.S. when she was just 17. She was the first female executive chef at Canoe House at Mauna Lani on the Big Island. HBR contributor Sarah Burchard spoke to Chef Rhoda about her career and transition from Los Angeles to the Kahala Coast.
It's surprisingly seamless. Really, I mean, especially Big Island, you know, it's could not be any more different. But I've always just seeked a quieter environment and a quieter life and just slower. I love that there's one road in and out of anywhere you go and there's no traffic. There's less food options, which is fine. It's like, I think I can manage to make something that I'm craving every once in a while. But yeah, I love it here so much. And actually, before I moved to Hawaii, I was in Santa Barbara, like wine country. So, you know, a little bit slower than Los Angeles. So I was kind of like transitioning into the island life, I guess you could say.
Did you know a lot about like Hawaii local cuisine and also like Hawaii regional cuisine? Did you know a lot about those cuisines before you got here?
I didn't. I've known of it. And I know it goes beyond like the musubis and the plate lunches and things like that. And what I'm still discovering and I'm loving about it is just all the things that I'm learning that grow here. It's incredible. Might not be like enough to like sustain our giant restaurant like consistently, but it's always just fun to like get like a list from our local farmer like aggregate company that collects all of these beautiful produce from like all the different islands. And they tell us like they're going to have 15 pounds of those ferns.
Oh, yeah. Ho'io.
Yes. And just kind of thinking about how we can preserve them so we can extend their life, you know, like all these things. And so we've been doing a lot of preservation here at Canoe House. We've been doing a lot of pickling, a lot of, you know, fermenting and just making sure like we're honoring the ingredient as is. We're not letting them go bad.
Let's talk about Top Chef. Let's start with what was the application process like? Can you walk us through that part?
I think it's different for everybody. But, you know, for the most part, like we all go through the same process and you still have to put in the time and the effort to like submit everything you need to, you know, give them in order for them to like move on with your application. It's long, it's tedious, it's a lot of stuff. It almost kind of, you know, makes you just commit to it already. Because it's like, oh my gosh, this is so much work. Like, if I don't get in, like, I'd be so pissed.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I better get this after all this work.
Yeah. But, you know, it's so worth it, right? And you don't even think about how tedious and how annoying that whole thing is. You're just like, okay, thank goodness, you know, like now I can move on and just get on with my life and trying to be the next top chef, I guess.
Okay, so now you've gone through the application process, you've been selected, you're on the other side of the country. What was the day-to-day like over there?
I'm not sure how much I can divulge, but they take away all of your devices. We don't have access to recipes. Even if we brought a notebook with us with all of our recipes prior to coming there, like they take those away as well. They give you a blank notebook to like kind of regurgitate like everything that you've memorized up to that point. So it evens the playing field for everyone, which is fair. And you get to speak to your loved ones once a week. It becomes more and more frequently as the number of chefs dwindle down. But yeah, I mean, it's long days and it's early, early mornings. You get mic'd up. They take care of you, though. Like, you know, they bring you coffee. They bring you breakfast. Make sure you eat. I like to take naps when deliberation time comes because it takes so long for them to, like, you know, discuss who wins and who goes home. So, like, there's always a luggage of just comforters and, like, fluffy pillows and stuff like that that I, like, break out and, you know, just, like, find my corner. Everyone has their own coping mechanisms, I guess, like when it comes to that stuff. But it was, looking back, it was really fun, except for when it's not. And it's really exciting. And there's a lot of testing, like your mental fortitude. Like you got to be able to, like, you know, not freak out all the time.
And you have been the only chef in the history of the show to win back-to-back individual elimination challenges, right?
The first two.
What was just like the competition part like when you're like the timer was on and you're competing? Was that, did you feel like you were kind of in your zone or was it just anxiety ridden the whole time?
When you start cooking, it's just you and your tools and the food. Everything else leading up to that and everything else after that, those are all just noise and you're waiting and it's anticipating. But once the timer like starts until it goes off, you're just cooking. And it's the funnest part of it. Like it's probably like the easiest part. And obviously, like, you know, you have to mold your dishes to the challenges and they have to fit the challenges and they also have to taste good. They can't just be like, you know, okay, like technically this dish is, you know, it met the challenge, but obviously those things are important too. So you just have to be able to like not overthink things, which is so much easier said than done.
For the winning dishes that you presented, were those dishes that you had planned to make all along if you got to that level, or were they not because they didn't tell you what the theme was until the end?
Absolutely not. It wasn't even my second choice or third. Those dishes came up very organically as the competition progressed up until the finale when they told us what the theme of the finale is. And it was risky. It was a risky move, especially since I don't cook Filipino food professionally. And so, you know, like you're pulling from memory and I just had to do it. You know, like it felt right.
I'm glad you did that.
Thank you.
So you win the competition, you take home the title. How has it been back at the restaurant since you've been home? I heard there was a huge party.
There was a huge party. We did a viewing party here for the finale. A lot of people showed up and a lot of people like, you know, showed their love. And it was so overwhelming. It was overwhelming, but like in the best way. And the restaurant is as busy as ever. We want to be very careful how we handle reservations moving forward because, you know, obviously, like we don't want service to suffer. We don't want food to suffer. And we don't want to just care about the numbers. Like we want to be able to like be really thoughtful and just careful, like moving forward, you know, like we don't want to burn out our team members. And I know this is a busy time and it's a really important time because this is going to shape who we are moving forward. And we don't want people to feel like they're just a number. And we still want to be able to do what we do and do what we do best. So there's been a lot of demands for reservation, of course, but it's hard to just like say yes to everything.
That was Chef Rhoda Magmatang, winner of Bravo's Top Chef Season 23, talking with HBR contributor Sarah Burchard. Magmatang is the executive chef of the Canoe House at the Mauna Lani Auberge Collection Resort on the island of Hawaii. And now it's time to reveal the answer to today's quiz. Earlier today, we asked you how many former U.S. presidents have died on the 4th of July. We can tell you that only one president was actually born on the 4th of July, Calvin Coolidge. Unfortunately for John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and James Monroe, they didn't have that kind of luck. In a twist of fate, Adams and Jefferson died on the same day in 1826, mere hours apart, and Monroe followed exactly 5 years later, which means there are three former U.S. presidents who've passed away on the 4th of July. And while it seems like a 4th of July isn't especially bad day for U.S. presidents, it can just be as easily a dangerous day for everyday people. So please be sure to be safe around fireworks this year and don't drink alcohol before entering the ocean or operating a motor vehicle. That's our quiz today. We had no winners. We stumped you on that one. But if you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Ho'olana Pua, serving youth impacted by trafficking through prevention, intervention, residential treatment, and recovery programs. Volunteer opportunities at ho'olanapua.org.
A new novel in verse follows a Hawaiian teenager navigating her place in the world from the Pacific Northwest. The novel is titled An Expanse of Blue, and its author isn't so different from the main character. Ka'ua Mahoy Adams was born and raised in Seattle, Washington. She drew on her upbringing in the diaspora and her family's involvement in the church to craft the coming-of-age story. HPR's Jason Ubai spoke to Mahoy Adams about the new novel in verse.
So An Expanse of Blue is a young adult novel in verse about a 17-year-old Hapa Hawaiian girl growing up on the continent in the Pacific Northwest, similar to my own upbringing. Her name is Auli, and she's being raised in this very staunch, strict Catholic household and is feeling a little lost in life, a bit unseen by her mother, a little over-controlled by her father, and feels like she can't really live up to the high expectations that her seemingly perfect older sister has set. And then she finds out this really heartbreaking secret about her father, which sends her down this path of rediscovering who she is, what faith means to her, how her cultural identity as being Hawaiian, but growing up away from Hawaii, how that impacts who she is. And along the way, she meets a cute boy and they may or may not fall in love.
How much were you pulling from your own life and how much were you inspired by others in writing this book?
It was definitely a mix. It's very much a work of fiction, but there are little bits and pieces here and there that I pulled from my own experience. Mainly the fact of writing from the perspective of a girl growing up in the Hawaiian diaspora. That was a very defining experience of my life. And it was, you know, it was hard sometimes, like being so far away from Hawaii, my cousins and my grandparents and my aunties and uncles, and feeling somewhat culturally disconnected. So I pulled a lot from that experience. I also grew up Catholic, and there's a lot of like funny little things in there, like experiences that were very unique to my, or felt unique to my like experience in a youth group at church. So there's a lot of like they go to camp with their youth group, and they go to, or they put on a play for Easter and all this kind of stuff. So it's, I pulled on those sort of experiences as well.
Reading the book, I think this is the first one that I've read in verse, an entire novel. So why did you choose to write it in that format?
Yeah, so I actually tried to write An Expanse of Blue just in regular prose at first. So what you might expect when you open up a novel. But I had a really tough time writing it that way. I think because the topics covered in the book, there's some tough topics covered. And so I thought about giving poetry a try. I've always enjoyed writing poetry, and I had just never thought I would ever publish poetry. But now, so far in my very early career, I've only published poetry. So that's kind of funny how that works out. But I was inspired and encouraged by a mentor, an advisor of mine at Vermont College of Fine Arts, where I got my MFA in writing for children and young adults, Melanie Crowder. And she encouraged me to write the story in verse. So I wrote a couple poems, and I just completely unlocked the story for me from there. And I, Uli's voice just really came through. And that's kind of how I figured out she is a songwriter, and she loves to write in her journal. And so, yeah, it was kind of a happy accident almost.
What do you feel like reading this, I guess, or what were you trying to convey for readers by writing in this style?
First of all, I wanted to show, you know, the book is for young adults or the young at heart. You know, you don't have to be a teenager to read it. But when I was thinking about the young reader that I'm writing for, primarily, I wanted to, one, show them that poetry doesn't have to be scary. I think the way that poetry is often taught to us in school, it's kind of like this old style of poetry that can be somewhat intimidating and inaccessible for kids. So I wanted to show that poetry can be really fun and accessible. I also wanted to, when I was thinking about the young Hawaiian reader that I hope gets to hold this book in their hands, I wanted them to, whether they're living in Hawaii or not, to get a peek into the experience of the diaspora. And so if they're living on the continent, hopefully they feel seen. Hopefully they feel like that they're not alone in that experience. And then if they're living back in Hawaii, maybe learning a little more about the other Hawaiian kids like them growing up somewhere different, and how we share, even though we are growing up in different places, we share our common culture, and that's really what connects us.
It is interesting, I mean, talking about the connection. Have you ever felt that way when in your life, I guess with Nalu and Auli, they, like, you know, it's always like, oh, are you Hawaiian? It's like this kind of like, you always find each other. Do you find that in life, especially living on the continent, you know, able to find your people?
I find Hawaiians more and more, like, as I get older. But I have these very fond memories of being a kid and growing up in Washington State. And my parents would be like, we would just be out like running errands. And then my dad would like kind of spot someone. And I don't know, it's just like this like sense he would get in the back of his head. And he'd be like, are you Hawaiian? And they'd be like, yeah. And then you realize how small the world is. And they're like, oh, we have this person in common in our lives or whatever. And so I really learned from him that it's that when you spot each other sort of in the wild, to connect, to say hello, and to be brave about, like, sometimes I get a little anxious, like just going up to people and being like, are you Hawaiian? But the thing is, I haven't been wrong so far. And so I'm not going to stop now. And it's always just this wonderful, like, moment of connection and excitement when we find each other. It's always a really, like, full of love moment.
Can you talk about being an Indigenous author? And I know this is printed with HarperCollins under the Heart Drum imprint. So could you talk a bit about that and about the group?
Yes. Yeah, I would love to. So Heart Drum, like you said, is an imprint of HarperCollins and was started, I think, about 5 years ago in partnership with We Need Diverse Books, which is a wonderful organization whose mission is really about getting more diverse books on the shelves and into the hands of young readers. And Cynthia Leidick Smith, who is the author curator of Heart Drum, and Rosemary Brosnan, who was the only editor at the time, they came together to start this. And it has just blossomed into this wonderful group that is putting out these amazing Indigenous stories. And I felt really honored when they wanted to publish my book because I was the first Native Hawaiian they published. And so it was just really special to be included in their group and to be included as a part of their group of authors. And to have an imprint whose sole mission is to publish books, to publish Native stories by Native authors, is just so amazing. And I feel so lucky that I get to be a part of it, because when I was a kid, I could not find books that had Native characters in it, much less Native Hawaiian characters. I mean, I'm sure they might have been there, but it was difficult, you know, and there wasn't just like one imprint pushing out books like this. So yeah, I just feel like really, really lucky to be a part of it. And they've put out so many beautiful stories. And yeah, so I think it's really cool that I got to be a part of it. I sound kind of like a broken record, but.
Who do you think should read this book?
Like I previously mentioned, I wrote it for young adults, but that does not mean you have to be a young adult. It's for everyone. I think that people who maybe are a little scared of or apprehensive about poetry should definitely pick it up. It's a great access point into poetry. Also, for parents and teachers and librarians who know of kids who are maybe a little more reluctant readers, this is a great choice, especially like you said, it's a quick read, so it's not too intimidating. And then, of course, I'm very hopeful that Kanaka kids and teenagers will get their hands on this book and hopefully see a bit of themselves reflected back in it. This book isn't just for Kanaka kids, though I hope that it gets in their hands. But I think that anyone can pick up this book and relate to the very teenage experiences in it. I've had friends who are in their 30s read it and be like, oh my gosh, this transported me back to being 17. And so there are universal themes that we all experience regardless of our identities as teenagers. And so I'm hopeful that anyone who picks up the book will find a little bit of themselves in Auli.
We've been hearing from Native Hawaiian author Ka'ua Mahoe Adams. She was chatting with HPR's Jason Ubai about her debut novel, An Expanse of Blue. It's out now and available wherever books are sold. Mahoe Adams will also be in the islands later this fall to visit local bookstores. And that's all we have time for today. Tomorrow, we have special programming in place for the 4th of July holiday. Give us some feedback about how your holiday went. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Want to listen back to any of our segments? You may not realize what you missed. Find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and Kevin Allen. Belai is our summer intern. And we've had additional support from the HPR digital team. Mahalo to John DeMello for our backyard quiz theme, Gypsy 808 for our theme music. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday for more of The Conversation.